Adi, welcome to the first lecture of the Atlas Shrugged course. I should begin with an apology. During the lecture, it may be that I'll have to interrupt for a few minutes because there's a plumber scheduled to come to my apartment. I couldn't get him for any other time. Now, I think I fixed the problem already, but he should be here, so I've been a bit scattered today. I should tell you also, I won't be up to my usual self, which is not very much to begin with, because I don't know if any of you've been following. I had a review on the Mises Daily site of a book by Stefan Molyneux, whom I wasn't really familiar with before I looked at his stuff. Did any of you see my review of Molyneux? I don't know if you saw that, but it wasn't very favorable. So it turns out he has an enormous number of followers, and I've been all sorts of posts attacking me, and it'll be going on more, I think, tomorrow, because I have another article that's responding to his response. So there's going to be, I suspect, some trouble tomorrow. But that doesn't have anything to do with our course. Now, before I begin the lecture, I just want to explain a few things how the course works for those of you who haven't taken my courses before, of course, from the Mises Academy. I usually lecture for about an hour or so, and then there's a half hour for questions and discussion. And for those of you who want to take the course for credit, there's a weekly quiz. This normally consists of 10 multiple choice questions, and I usually make them pretty easy. Oh, just one thing, Dan, is the chat room working all right? I saw two people type something in, but I'm not seeing anything after that.
It should be okay.
The last one I'm seeing here says, Paul Hagee to all attendees, good test. And then I don't see it. I'm not able to click. It isn't, there's nothing moving or anything.
Okay, I'll check on that. Feel free to just go ahead with the lecture and I'll take care of it.
Okay, great. Okay, so also, just one more preliminary thing. Sorry to have so many preliminaries. Just so you won't get the wrong idea of the course, in the course I'll be giving a lot of illustrations from Atlas Shrugged, but what I'm doing in the course is really using Atlas Shrugged, which was Ayn Rand's greatest novel, to illustrate points of her philosophy. So what I'm trying to do in the course is give an account of objectivist philosophy using the book. I thought this is a somewhat painless way to learn about objectivism because it's more fun when you can look at fictional illustrations. But if any of you want a literary analysis of the book or something about, like, say, we'll be going through the book episode by episode, that isn't what we're going to be doing, so we should just be clear about that. Okay, now, one thing I'm sure all of you have come across Rand before, and say you've read her either Atlas Shrugged or other great novel, The Fountainhead, but if you just look at her novels and that's all you know about her, she would be most famous for two things, really. First, she's a defender of capitalism. When Atlas Shrugged appeared in 1957, the free market was really unpopular as an ideology among intellectuals. People just didn't go in for that. So everybody was everybody important, with a few great exceptions, like the Mises, was somewhat of an interventionist or socialist. So she became very famous as a defender of capitalism. And also she was famous as a defender of ethical egoism. She had a collection of essays called The Virtue of Selfishness. And she picked that title just to arouse people, because normally we think of a selfish person as a bad person. A selfish person is someone who grabs everything for himself or herself. Say if there is some, imagine there's a dessert out, and the selfish person will just go to the dessert and get everything and not leave anything for anybody else. As my great friend, Father James Sadowski, likes to say, I like to get to the dessert first ahead of all the greedy and selfish people. Okay, I see now the thing is working. The chat is working good. Okay, so Rand is known then for capitalism and ethical egoism. But contrary to what you might think if you just come across Rand from the novel, those views, the capitalism and ethical egoism, aren't the basis of her philosophical system, or not the foundation. And she thought that both the defense of the free market and the ethical egoism were consequences of more fundamental principles. So they're not the ground floor, the foundation principles. They come in later as something you get once you understand these foundational principles. Now, what is the foundational principle of her thought? Well, the best way we can understand that is if we think about the name of her philosophy, which is objectivism. So what would you think? Well, if you see objectivism, what would this contrast with? And obviously it would be subjectivism. So she's saying she's an objectivist. And what she meant by that what the main aim of philosophy was the accurate grasp of existence. So fundamental thing she's opposing, she said a lot of philosophies, the one she's opposing, and we will see this in the novel also, people will just try to make up reality according to their own ideas. They'll just say, well, the person says, well, I have some sort of idea, I'd like it, instead of people being dominated by self-interest, wouldn't it be nice if we were all altruistic and unselfish? Just an example, there's a very outstanding philosopher who died a couple years ago named Jerry Cohen at Oxford. He was a socialist, and he said, well, look, the free market is just based on greed. Wouldn't it be better if we all had the same sort of attitude toward each other in society as we would do, say, if we're going out on a camping trip with people? So just like when we're out on a camping trip, we don't say, well, here's what I want, I'm going to sell you a tent or something. Shouldn't we all view each other as friends and people that we don't, we're just all together with? And so what he's really doing there is just constructing the world the way he would like it in his own mind. So Rand was very much opposed to that. She said what philosophy should do is accurately grasp existence. Now you might think at first that this seems like an odd point to emphasize, because you'd say, well, who, aside from a few unusual figures, would deny that they sought to attain truth? I mean, if you ask Jerry Cohen, are you aiming for truth? He'd say, sure, he wants to describe things as they actually are. Who's going to say, well, I don't care about reality, I just care about making up things the way I want them. Who would say that? They might say, well, why is Rand putting so much emphasis on this? You see, well, in her view, she didn't see matters that way at all. She didn't think that everybody is really trying to grasp reality. Even if people said, well, that's what they're trying to do, she said, no, that isn't right. There's just some philosophers who are trying to grasp reality, trying to get an accurate grasp of reality, and others aren't. And she sees the history of philosophy, and this is kind of giving a novelist perspective on history of philosophy. She's very good at, as you'll see when you read Atlas Shrugged, she's very good at telling the story. And she sees the history of philosophy as a story. It's one, the battle of the good people and the bad people. And the good people are the ones who give primacy to existence, who say what's important is what actually exists, the ones who are trying to describe reality. And the bad people, the villains, are those who defend what she calls the primacy of consciousness. So in order to make this view of the history of philosophy plausible, we have to grasp what she means by existence, because she's saying the good people, the good philosophers, are the ones who stress primacy of existence, and the bad ones are primacy of consciousness. So we obviously have to know, well, what does she mean by existence? Now, by existence, Rand meant primarily the physical world, that's the world disclosed to the senses and studied by science. So, you know, her famous sentence, existence exists. If what she's talking about is the physical world, say, where you're looking out, and unfortunately for you, you're seeing me. So that's part of the physical world. I'm part of the physical world. You're part of the physical world. We're all in the physical world. Now, it didn't fall from this, that she said existence is really the world which is closed to the senses and science. Thing. It doesn't follow from that the mental doesn't exist. On the contrary, she very much thought that consciousness exists. So there's the physical world and also consciousness. But she didn't believe that there's a separate mental realm that exists apart from the physical. So in her view, it isn't that here's the physical world out there that's composed of matter, and then there's also some sort of world that isn't material, the minds or the something else. Now, do you know which philosopher is the most famous for saying there's a division in the world between the physical world and the mental world? Do you know what great modern philosopher had that view? Where does that come from? Can anybody tell me that? Don't all hurry to be the first. Descartes. Descartes would say that the mind is a purely spiritual substance. So she's rejecting that. She says, sure, there's consciousness, but it's not separate from the physical world. So the view that she would very much reject would be idealism, which is a philosophy that claims that only mind exists. So, for example, in the philosophy of the great Irish philosopher, Bishop Berkeley, thought that everything that exists is really thought or acts of thinking. So if you see a material object, what you're really seeing is God's thought. So there's there we have images of things, but there's no matter in his view. They're just, we have images that we can see those, and the reason we, the images stay the same when we that you turn around, that we're looking at a book, and then we turn around, and we say, well, isn't the book still there? That's because the book doesn't consist, in Barclay's view, of our own images or our own sense data. It's really God's sense data that he's putting there. There's no matter. So she wouldn't accept that at all. She said, there's the physical world, that's the primary thing. And she also rejects views that say, there's a separately existing realm of universal. Now, what are universals? Well, a universal is something like a predicate. So as I say, there are different objects that are red. Their name, universal is a word that designates the quality of things. So there are some people who think, well, in addition, we can have, say, a red dress, a red book, or a red sweater. There are some people who think there's a separate existing thing that isn't a material thing called redness. That is an abstract object that exists apart from things that are red. There's something called redness that exists just independently. So she didn't accept that. She didn't, the qualities of predicates in her view don't exist separately. All that we have is matter. And there's consciousness that doesn't exist separately from matter, and qualities don't exist separately from matter either. So basic thing is, her view is primacy of existence, and it's basically referring to a physical world. Now, given this way of looking at things, where what you're stressing is existence, meaning the existence of the physical world, the world disclosed to senses, this is the primary thing, is consciousness, but that's not separate from matter. There's no independent realm of universals, and universals are just the qualities that things have, like being red or being square, or any kind of predicate would be a universal. So it isn't surprising that if she was looking at things this way, that she condemned Plato. Plato was one of the main people on the enemies list. And why was that? Well, remember I just said that Rand didn't think that universals existed separately. But Plato thought there's the really universals, these separate predicates, and other things as well that were non-material, that they were really primary. He had what he called the world of forms. And forms are really just something like abstract objects. The highest one is what's called the form of the good. So Plato would say, well, say we look around, we see different objects like tables and chairs. He would say, well, sure, they exist in some sense, but they're not the really, that isn't real existence. That's just an inferior type of existence. The material objects are really just copies of, inferior copies of the work, of the forms. What's real, what really exists, according to Plato, are these abstract objects. They include numbers in his. Numbers are abstract objects, qualities are abstract objects. So that's what really exists. So Rand says, if you say that abstract objects are what really exists, the material objects that we see, everyday objects are just copies of those, she said that's denying reality. You can see why she would think that, because remember, on her view, the material world is primary. So if you say, well, the material world isn't really that important, it's just a copy of something else, she's going to say that's denying existence. And according to Rand, she considers the Platonic tradition, which is all of philosophy that has been influenced by Plato, she thinks is the key source of irrationalism throughout the history of philosophy. Now, the British and later philosopher Alfred North Whitehead, who later taught at Harvard, in his book Process and Reality, says that the history of philosophy is a series of footnotes to Plato. So if you take what he says seriously, if he's right, and then if you think Rand's right, as a source of rationalism, you're going to be condemning a lot of philosophy, because of course, if philosophy is a series of footnotes to Plato, and then Plato is a source of rationalism, that's going to get rid of a lot of philosophy. So why does Rand say that this Platonic tradition is a source of irrationalism? It doesn't sound like it would be. I mean, suppose you say there's some world of abstract objects, say with numbers and qualities, that more real in the world of the physical senses. You might think that's not the correct view of things, but why would you think that? Why would that have to lead to irrationalism? Well, the connection that Rand saw there was she thought that if you think that there's some kind of knowledge apart from what we get through sense, apart from what we get by looking at physical objects or getting information with senses and trying to come up with abstractions in the sense, she thought if you think that there's some kind of other knowledge which you just get kind of from directly seeing these abstract objects, she said that's a type of mysticism. You're claiming you can kind of get direct insights into the nature of reality just by kind of looking at these abstract objects. Remember in Plato's Republic, you have the famous passage where the philosopher comes out of the cave and then is blinded by the sunlight. He's seen the forms, he's seen the higher forms. So she takes that to be a kind of mysticism, and she rejects that. Now, as you would expect, she was an atheist, because remember she said what's real is the physical world, the world disclosed to us by the senses. And God is almost always taken to be a non-physical being. God is a spiritual being. There have been a few philosophers who thought believed in God as a material being. Thomas Hobbes might have been one of those. The Christian apologist Tertullian was probably another one. But most people who believe in God think that God is a spiritual being. And according to Rand, there aren't any spiritual beings apart from the physical world, so she's just on that grounds alone going to be an atheist. So even though she's an atheist, she has a very favorable view of Thomas Aquinas, the great medieval philosopher. And why is that? Well, the philosopher she really likes the most is Aristotle, who is Plato's student, lived from 384 to 322 BC. So Aristotle didn't reject what Plato said entirely. He didn't think there's no such thing as the realm of abstract objects that Plato was talking about. But he thought that the abstract objects really just existed in the physical objects. They didn't exist apart from, so there would be, according to him, such a thing as a universal redness, but redness didn't exist in some kind of special spiritual world apart from physical objects that were red. Redness existed in the physical object. So Rand thought that was a step in the right direction, that Aristotle was much more of an empiricist than Plato, Plato wasn't much of an empiricist at all. Aristotle said that knowledge comes through by abstraction from the senses. So Aristotle is very good. And then later Aquinas is very good because even though he believed in God, he was very much, in her view, a follower of Aristotle. He wrote a great deal on Aristotle. He did commentaries on him, kind of. He's in the Aristotelian tradition. In her view, the revival of Aristotelian philosophy in Aquinas and other thinkers in the Middle Ages was principally responsible for the Renaissance, a great movement in Italy beginning in the late 14th century, kind of a revival of learning. Now, it's interesting, she takes that view because many historians of the Renaissance, such as Ernst Cassirer, think the Renaissance was really Platonic, was really influenced by Plato, but she follows those who say, no, the Renaissance was Aristotelian, and their historians of philosophy, the philosophy would agree with them. Now, so far we've got a couple of good guys, we've got Aristotle and Aquinas, the good guys, and we have a lot of bad guys. We have Plato's a bad guy. Oh, just one sec, this is the summer. Could you hold on?
I think I might have fixed it with me after I broke the ass with the plungers. I'll show you.
Thanks. We just had to take the plunge there. Sorry about that. Okay, so where were we explaining Ayn Rand's view of the Renaissance, that she thinks the Renaissance is primarily Aristotelian? Ernst Cassirer thought it was basically due to Plato. I think the Renaissance can be basically due to people with plungers, but I'm not sure whether the ones with the plungers were Aristotelian for lateness or neither. Okay, so Descartes, remember I mentioned him before.
Yeah.
Okay, everything's fine.
Yeah, everything's fine. Yeah, and working with
him. Okay, thanks a lot. Okay, good news, everything's working. Working fine. Let me just shut the door here. Again, I'm sorry for that interruption. This will happen, I guarantee, only every other class, not every class. Okay, so Descartes was another bad guy. And why would you think he would be a bad guy? Does anybody have a guess? Based on something I said already in the lecture. Martha says, I think, therefore I am. Well, wouldn't that be a true statement? I mean, isn't that the way you could? That's true, but you're on target because what he did was, Descartes was saying, we should doubt everything we can possibly doubt, so we can doubt anything we get through the sense of it. Suppose I say, you think you're seeing me now, what could be some kind of illusion? Suppose there is some kind of evil spirit who's just creating the illusion in you that you're now seeing me. Maybe it would be a good spirit, so you might not really see me. It's not self-contradictory to think, according to him, I'm not really seeing any physical object. You know, I think I am. But he said, well, I can't doubt that I exist because, look, if I'm doubting, then somebody has to be doubting. So I'm doubting, so I can't deny my own existence. So what he's doing is he's starting from his own consciousness. He's saying, I'm starting from my own conscience, and then Descartes goes on to try to prove the existence of God and says, well, God exists, so God wouldn't deceive us in making us think there's a physical world if there wasn't one. But so what he's doing, he doesn't reject the external world, but he says we start with our own consciousness. So this is the wrong way to do things, according to Rand. Maury says it quite right. Descartes says thinking is more important than existence. Well, you start with thinking. According to Rand, that's wrong because existence is primary, meaning the existence of the physical world, so you have to, in her view, start with that. And then another thing, of course, I mentioned earlier, Descartes thought that minds were not composed of matter at all. He was a dualist, and Rand doesn't accept that. She said, well, certainly there are minds, we all have minds, but minds are not separate from matter. Now, as I mentioned already, this is just a little bit of review. So we have these villains, but the source of the good tradition was Aristotle. Because, as I said, although there are Platonic residues in his thought, he didn't get rid of these abstract objects and universals altogether. He thought they were in the object. They didn't exist independently of the object. He emphasized that knowledge was gained through the senses, and he denied the independent existence of a world of universals. So he's basically a good guy because he says he doesn't get to the primacy of existence altogether, the existence of the physical world. So he says, well, there are universals true. Also, there are abstract objects that are non-material, but they don't exist independently of the world of the senses. Now, he also did believe in that there were in God. She doesn't really go into that very much in her account of Aristotle. That wouldn't really fit in. God isn't a material being for Aristotle. That really didn't fit into the picture, but even if he had certain Platonic influences to his codenum, he's still pretty good. Now, as I mentioned earlier, she thought that this, when I talk about her attack on mysticism, she said if there's this independent world of universals, then people say that, or then you have some knowledge apart from what you get through the senses, so that's, in her view, irrational. That's mysticism, because rational knowledge can only come by abstraction from the senses. So, as you would expect, and as I mentioned before, she rejects belief in God. Atheism is fundamental. And she has, what would be one argument she has for atheism? Well, she thinks if God exists, then the physical world is controlled by God's mind, because God has created the physical world and God is traditional conception of things. He's all powerful. He knows everything. Everything is subject to God's will. So then, in her view, that would mean if God's mind is controlling the world, then the world doesn't have a fixed nature. Because the world could, in her view, then could just be anything that God wants it to be. So it wouldn't have a fixed nature. And in her view, that's rejecting existence, because the world is the physical world, and the physical world has a nature. We'll see what's involved in that very shortly. But everything has in the world has a fixed nature. It must be a certain way. So in her view, it's not subject to control by God or changing around by any being. I should say, I'm giving you this because shouldn't be taken as endorsing these. I'm just trying to explain what her view is, not that my views of things matter, but I'm just expounding what she said. Now, one of the fundamental points about judging, which I already suggested, if you came to my introductory lecture last Friday, I was talking about the introductory lecture, of course, on Atlas Shrugged. Remember, in the whole point of Atlas Shrugged is it's the struggle between the creators and great creators and inventors like John Galt and Hank Reardon, and then the ones, the opponents, the ones with government agents and parasites like Jim Taggart, who were trying to interfere with them. So for Rand, philosophical ideas are all important. So you have in the novel, you have a struggle between those who believe in the importance of creation, productivity, and those who believe in a philosophy of parasitism and altruism. So in her view, when we're studying philosophy, this isn't something that's just a theoretical importance. This has all sorts of, it really determines human history. So she thought, in fact, ideas are the primary factor in human history. Just you, for those of you who studied Karl Marx, Marx thought the material forces that force the production of primary, so she's saying, no, that's not right. It's philosophical ideas are the most important. Ideas are the primary factor, and the most important ideas are the philosophical ideas. So when she's trying to come up with what she thinks is the correct philosophy, which is really a modification and development of Aristotle's philosophy, it emphasizes the primacy of existence even more than Aristotle did. She thinks this is a matter of world-shaking importance. If we have the correct philosophy, then we can grasp existence the way it really is. As an illustration, there's a book by one of her followers, Leonard Peikoff, called Ominous Parallels, that traces the growth of the Nazis to Kant's philosophy. I should tell you before I start going into that a little bit, I did a review of that book in 1982. It got me into tremendous trouble because I thought there were a lot of problems with the book, and when I suggested that in the review, a great many people who were like Peikoff or very strict followers of judgment attacked me. In fact, that was the review I gotten attacked for more than anything up until this review last week that I did of Stefan Molyneux. And I must say, I hope you agree with me. Don't you think it's very unfair that just because I say nasty things about a book, the people who write those books come after me and attack me? Somehow that strikes me as grossly unfair. I hope you agree with me about that. Now, we can, as I just mentioned, we can see the importance that Rand gives to ideas. If we look at the basic plot of Atlas Shrugged, and I went over some of this a bit last week, but I misspelled inventors, isn't that just like me? Okay, the whole novel, it revolves around the ideas of creators and inventors like John Galt and Hank Reardon. What they say is they're coming up with all these great new products, like Reardon had a new form of steel that's much lighter and stronger than anything previously. Galt had a new motor. So they're coming up with all these great new ideas are going to benefit everybody, make the world a better place, we'll all have a higher standard of living. But against them, there are all these destructive people. People say, well, it's wrong to want to excel. We should want to share everything. Everybody has to be equal. we should, instead of thinking how we can advance ourselves, we should try to help those who are unfortunate. So the novel is really just that struggle between Gall and Reardon, people think in their fashion, and then there's the destructive ideas of the altruists and also the people who are parasites who want to seize control of the resources, these productive, creative people, and just take them over for themselves. And Rand thinks that behind much altruism, the people say, well, we have to help the poor and less fortunate. She thinks, in fact, a lot of this disguises parasitical behavior on the part of certain people who aren't creative themselves, that one sees what the creative people have come up with. Jim Taggart is one of the heads of the steel company. His sister, Dagny Taggart, is the principal female lead in the book. She's one of the creative people, but Jim Taggart is one of these people who just tries to get by political scheming. Wesley Mooch, Rand has fun names for some of these characters, is someone who becomes one of the main people in the government bureau who's trying to control what the creators are doing. Dr. Ferris is the head of Scientific Institute. He wants to bring all these inventors under government control. Mr. Thompson is the head of state. So the whole novel, you see, shows the importance of ideas in her thought. Now, what I've been talking about so far is Rand's ideas about metaphysics. And metaphysics isn't what something isn't, doesn't refer to something that sometimes you see in bookstores, metaphysics in books on occultism. But here, metaphysics doesn't mean that. Metaphysics is the study of the nature of reality. So when I was saying that, according to Rand, there isn't an independent realm of abstract objects, that metaphysics, which says that the physical world is primary, that's her doctrine of metaphysics. But she also had views, go along with these metaphysical views, in epistemology, which is the philosophical study of how we know. So according to her idea on epistemology, the mind begins as a blank slate, or Latin tabula rasa, blank slate. So she's opposed, some people think the mind, we start off with certain innate capacities or innate ideas. Descartes was one of that, but we have certain concepts that we don't get from the external world. We're just born with these concepts. So they develop in us independently of what goes on in the physical world. One view is maybe things in the physical world trigger these concepts in our mind, but once they're turned on, imagine something in the physical world striking us and then just turns on something in our mind that's already there. She didn't hold that view. She said, no, we start off with the mind just a blank slate. Now, when we get all these things coming into our senses, we're seeing various things, hearing things, feeling things, touching things, then she thought the mind can grasp similarities and differences among the different concrete entities that we're perceiving. So we're perceiving all these different entities, and we see what's similar in them. Say we see a red book, a red dress, red table. So we see there are all these different items that are similar in this way that they all, and she said the mind can grasp that. So what the mind does, it says, well, it can consider this similarity apart from the concrete entities that they're bound up with. So instead of thinking just red book, I can just consider the quality red. Now remember, the key mistake, according to your report, is that the red actually exists apart from the object, that there's some kind of redness apart from the object. He said, no, that's just a concept in our mind that we've acquired through a process of abstraction. We looked at all these objects and we say, well, she calls this measurement omission. We see they're different in various ways, say red book, the red color is connected with the book, and the red apple is connected, red is connected with the apple. We can cut out all the dissimilarities, we just get the concept through process of abstraction. And then we can build these abstractions into a system. We can get further abstractions from the abstraction. Say, well, I see, I get the the concept of red, and then I can get the concept of blue, concept of yellow. Then I can make an abstraction from all those, get the concept of color. We can make a system of all these different abstractions. But what's very important for it is that all these abstractions really come from the senses. Okay? We start off, remember, the mind is a blank slate, and then it's getting to the concepts by abstraction from the senses. So if we just come up with some concept that isn't derived from the senses, as she would say, concept of God isn't something we get through the senses. She said, well, that's meaningless because we didn't get it in the proper way. Concepts have to be derived by abstractions in the senses. And if someone claims to have a concept that isn't, then that concept is illegitimate. Now, according to her, if we, and this is where we get into a point I was trying to raise at the beginning, remember I said Rand is best known because she was a defender of capitalism and she defended egoism, but those weren't primary. And then I said, well, what is primary? It's the metaphysics and epistemology. Metaphysics is primacy of existence, primacy of the physical world, and epistemology, we get our knowledge by abstraction from the physical world. So that's a foundation, but now we have to see, well, how does that foundation get us to these views about ethics being based on egoism and then eventually to support for capitalism? Well, according to her, if the existence is primary, then ethics has to be based on reality. And how will it be based on reality? Well, it's really based on human biology. So we can't come up with an ethical system just by say, thinking about the nature of, kind of say, well, what this is, what does reason just by itself require of us if we're trying to be ethical? She said, no, if you want ethics based on existence, you have to say, base it on human biology. Now, well, what happens if you try to do that? Well, we have to understand that man, and she always refers to, she wasn't someone who went in for political correctness, of course she largely lived before those days, but when she always, she won't say human being, she'll always say man does such and such, that's the way she refers to the human species. So she said man, unlike other animals, doesn't survive by relying on instinct. Say, if a cat sees a mouse, it's going to go after the mouse. It isn't going to think to itself, well, do I want to have a eat a mouse right now? It's just built a certain way, so it's going to go after the mouse. But human beings aren't like that. We don't rely on instincts. I think Kirby, we don't even have instincts at all. So we have to use reason in order to survive. And in her view, the goal and standard of ethics for each person is that person's own survival. So she's saying, well, with other animals, say if you take any animal we want, like an ape or a tiger, the ape or tiger will be biologically programmed to survive. But we're not biologically programmed. We have to use our reason if we want to survive. Now, here's where the pro-capitalism part comes in. How do human beings survive? Well, if we're going to survive, we need to have establish a political system that recognizes individual rights, in particular property rights, because if we don't do that, we're not going to be able to get a system of social cooperation where we can all benefit through exchanges. Those of you who are familiar with the works of von Mises and Henry Hazlitt, I've given courses on both of those. Also, I gave one course together with Danny Sanchez on it. He had the same idea, that the way human beings survive is best is to establish a system of social cooperation through the free market. So the only productive economic system is laissez-faire capitalism, a system of free market where the government doesn't interfere. And she thinks the government has to be strictly limited to defense and justice, or the government just defending us against aggressors or against criminals as a justice system. But unlike Murray Rothbard, I think she was wrong here, but regardless of my views, this is what she thought. She didn't believe in competition among private protection agencies. She thought within each territory there should be only one legitimate protection agency. I think the main reason she thought that was she thought, well, if there are competing agencies, this will just lead to some kind of warfare between them. We need to have a stable legal system. She didn't really think we could have that with competing agencies. Now, so this gives us a basic understanding of it, of the outlines of Ratzlaff. I had to go through the metaphysics and through knowledge and the ethics and political economics and just three. But now I want to go back and we want to look in a little bit of time remaining in the lecture, and then we'll go into this in more detail in the lecture next week. We want to look at more closely at Rand's metaphysics, study nature, reality, and epistemology, the theory of knowledge. Now, the fundamental principle of objectivist metaphysics is the law of identity. A is A. And you'll see, if you look at Atlas Shrugged, at one of the sections has this law of identity, one of the titles of the section. And this is taken together with the principle of non-contradiction, which is nothing is both A and not A. So what law of identity says, a thing is what it is, and it isn't something else, that's law of non-contradiction. So everything is what it is. As Bishop Joseph Butler put it in, said, everything is what it is and not another thing. I think that would be a good summary of Rand's basic metaphysical principle. Now, almost all logicians accept these laws. There are a few who question the law of non-contradiction. But the way most logicians take them, they're taking them as purely formal laws. What do I mean by that? Well, suppose you had a proposition that was in the form A and not A. They would reject that. So they would take this just as the proposition would just be, you'd be looking at certain formal symbols. And if you see formal symbols that have this form A and not A, you throw that out. Just like a mathematician, if you see 2 plus 2 equals 5, you're going to say that's wrong, throw it out. But according to the way most logicians take these laws, these laws really don't tell you anything about the nature of anything. They're just purely formal. They don't tell you, suppose the world just consisted, the whole universe just consisted of, pulses that just existed for a mini second, and that these different things had nothing in common with each other. You just had all these little pulses of things that went on, and that was the whole everything consisted of. That would be perfectly consistent with law of identity, according to most logicians, because law of identity isn't saying anything about what the world is like. But Rand didn't take it that way. Rand thought you can get much more from the law of identity. You can get that everything has a fixed nature to it. And I just want to give you, so we can see this in Atlas Shrugged, at the end of Atlas Shrugged, kind of the climactic scene, John Galt takes over the radio station, gives a long radio broadcast on his philosophy, where he explains why he went on strike with all these other creators, what is the basis of his thought is. This is key statement of Jefferson's philosophy. So this expresses what he says, the points of law and identity. He says, centuries ago, the man who was, no matter what his errors, the greatest of your philosophers, and here he means Aristotle, has stated the formula defining the concept of existence and rule of all knowledge. A is A. A thing is itself. This is just what I was saying. But I can't see the front of it. We said, you've never grasped the meaning of his statement. I am here to complete it. Existence is identity. Consciousness is identification. So what does he mean by that? He said, well, if a thing is what it is, what we're trying to do is anything that we're saying, we're trying to identify what the nature of that thing is. So this is the basic principle of metaphysics. Now, I haven't, so far I said, well, objectivists really read into that law more than most logicians do. Most logicians just take it in a purely formal way. I haven't really explained what is the difference between the way the objectivists look at law of identity and the way most logicians would. Well, according to objectivists, all of the properties of an entity are part of its essence. So, supposing, as I think is true, light travels at 186,000 miles per second approximately. So it has to do that. That's a defining characteristic of light. So, the law of identity, according to them, objectivists said all of an object's properties are necessary. They couldn't be other than they are. So, the heart pumps blood in a certain way through the body. Well, it has to do it that way. It's necessary to do it. It couldn't be otherwise. The actual world is not only the only world there is, the only world that could be. So she's really identifying what's actual and what's necessary. There aren't possible worlds. Sometimes logicians talk about possible worlds other than the actual. Rand doesn't think there are any possible worlds other than the actual. The only exception to this is human free choice. She thinks that's the only example of alternatives in reality. The physical world is otherwise completely necessary. So you can see this is a much stronger view of identity from what you would get just by considering law of identity as a logical law. Now, supposing an entity's properties are necessary, so all the properties of the entity couldn't be otherwise than there are. Well, some of the properties of an entity include causal properties. Part of the properties, say, of you think, well, let's just think of something. Suppose you thing, because the sun is not just the physical object that is out there. The sun is acting in a certain way, doing things, not in such, of course, that human beings act, but it moves in a certain way, at least internally. Things, physical processes are going on in it, so it's causing things. So those properties also are necessary. And in her view, another thing she holds is that nothing can come into existence without a cause. So something couldn't just pop into existence without a cause. She thinks that violates the law of identity. Whether it does or not, be an interesting thing to talk about, but that's what she thinks. So what will we get from all this if nothing can come into existence without a cause and everything that exists is necessary? She says that the ultimate material constituents of the world existed eternally because, well, we know that they exist now because otherwise there wouldn't be anything. Physical world is all that there is, so physical world now exists. But whatever is ultimately composing the physical world couldn't just pop into existence. It's always existed. And why is that? Because nothing can come into existence without a cause, but nothing could be the cause of these ultimate material constituents of the world because they're the ultimate constituents. So you couldn't have anything more ultimate than that, than those constituents, so they have to exist eternally. And there isn't an alternative set of existence either, because remember she said whatever exists in the world couldn't be otherwise. So the world, the physical world, is really a necessary being, according to her. Okay, well, I think that's enough metaphysics for one day, and we've seen how it comes into Atlas Shrugged. So I think in the time that's left, we'll have devote to questions. So I'm going to go, you can type questions in the chat if you want, but I'm going to go to the Q&A, I'm going to open that, so you can type your questions in there, and I'll look in both, but probably better if you type your questions or comments in the Q&A box. Don't all hurry to be the first. Yeah, I mean, oh, here's one. Maury says, concept does not come to the sense would necessarily be meaningless because meaning is the existing unit. Meaning is not the definition. Yes, I think that's right. What you're doing, according to her, is when you're getting concepts through abstraction, the various objects will have the quality like red in a certain quantity or certain amount. What you're doing is omitting these quantities. That's what she calls measurement omission. So if you have nothing in the senses, there's nothing to omit there. So I think you're quite right. You wouldn't be able to come up with a unit without the senses in her view. Now, Paul says, what political party, if any, would Rand ally with? Well, I think she started off with she supported Wendell Willkie as a Republican candidate in 1940, and then she tended more to support Republicans than Democrats, but she wouldn't support Ronald Reagan because I think he opposed abortion. She was very much in favor of that. But she generally didn't identify with a particular political party. She would just say whatever one came closest to her ideas, if she could in good conscience support that, she would go along with. When Alan Greenspan was made head of the Fed, you know, Alan Greenspan was was a member of her inner circle, so I think she supported him. Now, John says, I don't believe they had a government in conclave Colorado where the anarchists said, well, remember, what they're doing in this little community, they're not, even though they're, remember, they're just out on strike for a while, I don't think they're intending to set up a full-fledged society, so I don't think she would have denied that people could just set up their own communities. But remember, in the conflict, there aren't competing protection agencies either. So I think she would say, well, if they all decide just to establish the community as a separate community, they would have just done so with one group. They were kind of all united. There wouldn't be competing agencies. Now, Nathan says, did Ren ever get this idea on choice of causal, and thus we have no free result chemical engineering within our brain, thus we have no free will? Well, that actually, there's a famous incident involving that. What Rand held was, if you say that, she endorsed, at one time, I think it went toward the beginning of her life, she was sympathetic to determinism in the way you're suggesting, but she came to reject that because she thought, well, suppose, let's assume that theory is true, so when I'm thinking of things, it's because there are chemical reactions in my brain that caused me to think that. So then she thought a problem with that is, well, let's take the statement chemical reactions within our brain are causing our ideas. So she would say, well, then what's causing that thought, chemical reactions within our brains? If that's the case, then she thought, well, we have no grounds to think the theory is true. It's just, well, I say determinism is true. It's just a chemical reaction in my brain. I don't really have any grounds to claim it's true, just like we wouldn't say, suppose you see just kind of some chemical reaction going on. You wouldn't say it's true or false. It's just there. So she thought if you say this, it leads to some kind of contradiction. Why that's a good argument or not, that's an interesting topic to dispute. There's something to it, I think. But the way it got into trouble with Murray Rothbard mentioned that argument in an essay he wrote. And it's a common argument in philosophy. In fact, some of the medievals had it, Immanuel Kant mentioned. But I think the objectors thought they'd come up with it, so they thought that Rothbard plagiarized from them because he mentioned this argument, but the author said, no, I didn't. It was a very common argument, but they didn't think that. Craig says, Craig has sent me a very interesting post earlier suggesting that Rand might very well like P.G. Wodehouse. I found that very persuasive. There's maybe something too. I'll have to look into that more. He says, I think the strong interpretation of ASA is justified if the formulation is valid and it follows. I think that's what Rand is arguing. Yes, I think that's she is saying something like she thinks the law of identity implies that things have fixed natures that can't be changed. Now, I would wonder, is that issue right about that? It's not clear to me how the argument's supposed to be going, but that's clearly what she thought. But I think you're right, that is certainly what she thought. Now, Jordan says, how is the best way to use Rand's arguments against those who say everything is welcome, not judge of reality, to back up their beliefs in socialism, other self-contradicting beliefs? Well, according to Rand, those people wouldn't, you could ask, well, she would say, how do these people come up with their concepts? She would say, if they don't get their concepts from reality, then they're just arbitrary. they're emphasizing what she calls primacy of consciousness rather than primacy of existence. So she would say those people are just making up things, they're just making the world the way they want. So what she would say, one way she would say, well, if you say you have these views, everything is relative and objective reality, well then your views can't claim to be true either, because if you say there's no truth or no objective reality, so that isn't that kind of a self-undermining view, because aren't you saying there's no objective reality, you can't even say that, so you really wouldn't be able to express your views if they were true. Wes asked me this tough question, I need to come up with a way of evading. I believe you indicated in the past that you're not an objectivist. Where do your thoughts depart from that an objectivist? Well, that's one, you know, this is really not a course in my philosophy. I'm more of a critic than someone in independent doctrine. But, I mean, I tend to think that Rand has interesting ways of looking at things, but I don't think they're not compelling. I mean, I just don't see what the argument, if you're just asking on my own view, then I'm going through these various arguments with you. It's just not necessarily the physical world that's primary, or that everything has a fixed essence and couldn't be otherwise. I'm not really seeing that you have to hold all that view. But, you know, I mean, I say it's not a course in my ideas, it's just what I want to give you now in the course is just try to get you to see things the way she says them. I mean, I think before we can start criticizing her views, really, we need to get the views out there. But, you know, I mean, I think if you're giving a course on my philosophy, nobody would take it, so what would be the point of that? Now, John says, what is the reality of a fictional character with Galt existing consciousness? Well, now that's a very interesting question. I don't think I think she would say that Galt was just an abstraction she'd come up with that she portrayed in the novel. I mean, Galt wouldn't be something that exists. It's really called just an idea in her mind that readers find out about by reading the novel. I mean, it would go against your views to say, well, there's some kind of independent realm of abstraction for fictional characters existed. So, there really, strictly speaking, there isn't such a person as John Galt. Just the character in the novel. But I don't think she addressed this question really explicitly. She had a lot of ideas on the nature of art and what the artist or the novelist should be aiming at. But I think the question of fictional characters is very important among contemporary philosophers. There's been a lot of work on that. I don't think that's the question she was that interested in. Maury says, what is the difference between reality and existence for Rand? Well, I could be wrong there, but I think she really doesn't differentiate them that much. I mean, I think those are really, I don't want to be absolutely committed to their absolute synonyms, but I don't think she makes a distinction. There are some people who do would say something like, well, reality, existence might be just the actual world, but then there's reality, there's also some possible worlds that exist, the possibilities that exist apart from the actual world. Now, I see up to this is terrible tonight. Was this the comment on my lecture, the sound, or both? Or hope it wasn't. I hope it's more of the sound than my lecture. Although being justified if it's a lecture, I don't know. Okay, Wesley said the creators would represent capitalism. The users would represent socialism. Well, the creators would certainly represent capitalism, but the users wouldn't have to be socialists, although they could favor other systems like regulation of capitalism, just taking things from market. There wouldn't have to be full socialism. Also on a sign around recovering Republican Forest and Libertarian Chapter Chair with advisory expertise on the Austrian School in Mises. So, oh good, so you're studying the Austrian School, that's very good. And what reading would you recommend start on Rothbard? You're already reading Hayek and Mises. Well, actually what's good to start with on Rothbard, I always like what is government done to our money is a very good way to start. And, I think Ethics of Liberty would be good. But now let's see, Everett says, she asserts that everything that exists must have a cause. Why isn't that circular reason? I'm not clear what would be the circle involved there. I'm not clear why you would think that. I mean, she thinks that if something existence is something that's sort of not, if there were existence and existing being can't just come pop into existence, I guess she takes that to be something that's evident or obvious. I think she could, if something could come into existence, then it wouldn't have a fixed nature. It would just be arbitrary, and she thinks that would go against the law of identity. I think that's her line of reasoning. So she said, well, if things would just come and go without a cause, they wouldn't have a fixed nature. We know from law of identity everything does have a fixed nature, so I don't think that circular reasoning. I mean, you might reject what she's saying, but I'm not seeing what the circle is. Now, Wes says, just to confirm my understanding of your point, Rand supported capitalism and free markets, her consequence of how she felt about life and knowledge. Yes, and she says that support of capitalism is not just a free standing. It isn't just, well, here's some good arguments in favor of the free market. It's the free market stuff comes from the ethical system. The ethical system is based on the metaphysics and theory of knowledge. Leslie said, I seem to remember Hegel's writing something like whatever is necessary, which would be like Rand's view, that wouldn't Hegel be very much in the primacy of consciousness camp? Well, yeah, I think she would say Hegel is just, in her view, she interpreted Hegel, which is not the way everybody does, but she would say Hegel is the view is the primacy of what he calls the absolute idea. He doesn't start with material reality. He started with the primary, with the primacy of the absolute idea. He said, what I think the statement Hegel makes is, what is actual is rational, what is rational is actual. So what exists is in accord with reason. It must be as reason, the absolute idea says. So I see there is some, it, he is saying kind of a different way from Rand, but what exists is necessary, but it's not the way she does it, because it's stressing the primacy of the absolute idea, which is kind of a, again, there are different ways of taking Hegel, but I think the way she took it was that she would take it to be kind of a, she would take the absolute idea to be kind of a spiritual entity, not based in the physical world. There are people who take Hegel in a way that might be much more compatible with what she said, but she didn't. And Mari said, would God be an artistic expression of reality even though he doesn't exist? Well, I mean, he doesn't exist as a physical being, but he certainly exists, he's a fictional character. I mean, he is expressing her sense, she's trying to express her sense of reality through her novel, the one of the main characters, which is Galt. So she doesn't, remember, she, when she's saying the primacy of existence, she's not denying that ideas exist, all of a sudden they're ideas that are, you get by abstractions, and there's the activities of creators, so they certainly exist also. So when you say Galt doesn't exist, it just means Galt isn't an independent physical object, but he's certainly a fictional character. Now Wesley says, on the flip side of the coin, wouldn't you say the user is destroying us as a principle on capitalistic principle? Well, that's a very interesting question. No, you see, it's certainly right, and this one thing I'll be getting into when I talk about her ethics. I mentioned it very briefly in that introductory lecture I gave last Friday. I think what you're thinking is, well, the users are out for themselves. So you could say, well, aren't the users self-interested people also? She said everybody should try to survive. So aren't the users trying to survive too? But remember, for her, in her ethicism, what you're trying to do is survive as a rational being, and you're not supposed to use anybody else. You can't interfere with anybody else's attempt to survive as a rational being. You have to respect the rights of others. And if you go to my introductory lecture last week, which I think you'll just get, if you didn't hear it already, you can just get into that for free. I gave a quotation from inscribed in Galt Gulch, where it's something like, I swear always to never to use anyone else, not to always live for myself, but never to use anyone else. So those people, the users, wouldn't be following the capitalist principles, even though they're kind of in a crude sense self-interested. However, it says she seems to look at causes infinite, like the number line. Well, I mean, for the physical world, you would just, at that point, I think you would just go back, say, in, you would just have things that would just exist eternally. So it wouldn't be really that something exists, then something before that thing exists, and then you just keep going back infinitely. There would be things that are always there. So they wouldn't have to have causes, and can you see why not? Something existed eternally, then it wouldn't need a cause, because anything that comes into existence has to have a cause. So she said that's why there's some things that don't come into existence, meaning the ones that existed eternally. So it's a bit like Aquinas using argument that like that to establish existence of God, but she said no, it isn't that God exists eternally, it just means she thinks there are physical entities that have always been there, because I think she would accept we couldn't have an infinite chain of cause, but that, according to her, would just show there are some beings that don't have causes, but a being that doesn't have a cause couldn't come into existence, so therefore it's existed eternally. Okay, David says, how would Rand view Kant's separation of a priori knowledge and a posteriori knowledge? Oh, he rejected completely, or she rejected completely. According to her, all knowledge comes from abstractions of the senses, so there isn't an a priori knowledge apart from the sense. There's an essay you might look at if you can get a hold of it, by Leonard Peikoff, called The Analytic Synthetic Dichotomy, I think, where he goes into that. Objections don't accept this division between the a priori and a posteriori. Leslie said, do you think Rand's principle would coincide with Mises' classical liberalism and the need for a physical property? I think they'd be very largely would agree with Mises. She'd differ with him more on the metaphysics epistemology, but there would be a very close alliance in political philosophy. And in fact, she thought very highly of me as an economist, not as a philosopher, but she did think that. Well, I guess we're about out of time now, unless someone has any last question. I hope the person who said things were terrible, I hope it's just a technical problem that might be getting hated in my lecture. Just one second. Okay, so I hope we'll see you all next week. Okay, thanks everybody. Thanks for coming. See you next week. Bye everybody. Okay, bye. See you all next week, I hope.